Do you really believe that you can bring life to the dead?
Welcome back to another episode of the Chainsaw Enema Show. I'm Johnny B. Ghoul.
And I'm Misfit Mike.
And for our second installment of our Universal Monsters episodes, we're talking about Frankenstein.
Yeah.
From 1931, same year as Dracula. Directed by the great James Whale. And for our top cast, we have the monster, played by in the movie at least. Well, the first part of it. At the end, it says his name. Boris Karloff, I'm sorry. Karloff the Magnificent, or what was it? Karloff the...
Or just Karloff.
He was going by Karloff after... Well, I don't think they started to call him the Man of Many Faces, but they said that he was like the next best thing right after Lon Chaney. Impressive for that time.
Yes, and I have to correct myself. In last week's podcast, I alluded to the fact that Boris Karloff was the Man of Many Faces, and I misspoke because it was Lon Chaney.
I must have missed that when I was editing. That's okay. There's a couple things that we were talking about that we weren't aware of at the time and weren't 100% accurate, but it's, you know,
we're chatting
about it and kind of learning as we go, too.
I got my dates mixed up on a couple of things. My brain ain't what it used to be.
Neither is mine. Aside from Boris Karloff, we have Colin Clive, who played Henry Frankenstein. He was outstanding for this role. I mean, of course, one of the top all-time quotes ever was the "It's alive,"
which got censored in so many different places.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that he had such a tragic life. I guess he was a
severe alcoholic.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. It's crazy to think about because I mean, he was so amazing in this part.
He was so young too. I think he was about 31 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And he died from tuberculosis.
Yeah.
He had heart problems and pneumonia. Put that all together, that'll kill anyone.
Yeah, he was in really bad shape.
6 years he died after this film. He was only 37. It's really amazing. It's really sad.
I guess they were worried about him being a part of the movie because they were so afraid he was going to go on a bender.
But also, I saw that James Whale was, for some reason, he was fascinated with the fact that he found an alcoholic to play in his film. Back then, being an alcoholic wasn't as bad of a word as it is today.
Right.
So, I mean, people looked at it very differently back then.
I guess.
A lot's changed.
I just don't understand that mindset. Hey, this is awesome. I found a alcoholic.
And then we also have Mae Clark, who played Elizabeth, who she also had kind of a rough life too. She actually quoted, though, working with Colin Clive was amazing. She went on record saying that he was just such a dearest, kindest man who gave you importance and that he was just wonderful and a very clever guy.
I guess she had nothing but good things to say about all the people on the film. She just gushed over Boris Karloff and James Whale, said they were all wonderful to work with, which doesn't surprise me. I mean, especially with Boris Karloff. I have not heard too many bad things said about him over the years. He, I guess, was a very intelligent, soft-spoken English gentleman.
Yeah, he was a big teddy bear. James Whale, on the other hand, we've all heard his tragic life. Well, he was a closet homosexual for a while there, because back in that time, it wasn't as accepted as it is today.
Right.
He had some personal and health professional problems. He committed suicide by drowning himself in the pool of his home in California on May 29th of 1957. He was only 67 years old, and he did leave a suicide note. Well, his longtime companion, Dave Lewis, he withheld it, which, I mean, I guess I can kind of understand it back then. I guess he didn't want anyone to know that he killed himself. He probably didn't want him to go out that way. So they ruled out his death as accidental. Everybody found out the truth decades later when he brought the note forward.
That's a shame. He was a very talented director.
Yeah, I've tried to look up a lot of different things about James Whale, especially after watching the movie, I think it's called Gods and Monsters, which is about the last remaining years of James Whale's life.
Yep.
It was a very hard watch. But it's very interesting to watch. Brendan Fraser plays in it. He's a main character. And I forget the dude's name. The dude from X-Men there who played Magneto. What's the actor's name?
Ian McKellen.
Yes, yes. He played James Whale in that movie. And it was a good watch. It was just really sad.
Yeah.
Some parts are a little cringy, but it was a pretty well-done movie.
Yeah, it's been a long time ago, but I did enjoy it when I saw it. As much as you can enjoy a movie like that.
Yeah. You know, the monster in this film doesn't physically resemble the character in the Mary Shelley's novel.
Oh, no, not at all.
Jack Pierce. If you don't know who Jack Pierce is, you got to look him up. He's pretty much responsible for all the Universal Monsters makeup from back then and a lot of other stuff. He was a terrific artist. And
oh, yeah.
He got fired from Universal Studios for some stupid reason later on, and they had a big falling out from what I've heard. But yeah, Jack Pierce came up with the innovations as far as the monster's flat head, the bolts through the neck, the droopy eyelids he worked on, and the poorly fitted suit. And so any future Frankenstein film that these features had was really taken its inspiration from Pierce's makeup work.
Yeah, he was an inspiration for a lot of the modern special effects artists we have now. I'm sure Tom Savini was influenced by him, as well as Tom Savini being influenced by Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah, there's interviews you can see with Tom Savini talking nothing but good things about Jack Pierce and a lot of these older movies. And if you watch the special features and stuff, there's a whole bunch of great people on. One in particular, Joe Dante, is on there a lot talking about these films and everything. And it's great to watch Joe Dante.
he seems like such
a good guy. Yeah. And Mae Clark, yeah, I was mentioning earlier, she had quite a life. She suffered severe major setbacks beginning a year after this film. Her career never fully recovered from. Apparently, she had a nervous breakdown in June of 32, and then another one 2 years later that was most likely caused by overwork, and I guess she had marital problems.
Oh, wow.
And also followed by a serious car accident in 1933. So all within this time frame, right after Frankenstein, she had some really just harsh issues she was dealing with.
That's too bad.
Yeah, in the last remaining years of her life, she didn't do much, but she lived a good long life. I think she died in, 1992, and she was like 81 years old or something like that.
All of the people in these movies we've been watching are dead.
Yeah.
It's kind of bizarre to think about, because you see
strange,
these...
strange, yeah.
You see these great movies with, you know, these amazing actors, and there's times where I get so into the movie, I'm thinking to myself, wow, I'd love to meet this person, and it's like,
yeah, you
but
can't.
They're dead.
You have to go dig them up. According to film historian Gregory W. Menck, I don't even know who he is. I found it in my notes here, but the director James Whale, this surprised the hell out of me, because I didn't know this. James Whale is jealous of the attention that Boris Karloff's monster was getting during the production, and I guess took revenge by making the actor carry Colin Clive up the mountain
to the
hill.
Yeah.
Over at the, when they're going up to the windmill.
I heard about that.
Dozens of times.
And because of that, he had to have like multiple back surgeries. And
he suffered with it the rest of his life, I guess. He had horrible back issues, and supposedly that it was because of this. And Clive, he felt badly for Karloff, and he suggested that a dummy be used instead. And I guess Whale refused, and Karloff continued to have to carry him. 6 foot, 154-pound body in succeeding takes. And if you watch the film, I think the only part they use the dummy is when he throws him off the mill, and then he lands on the mill, and he still lived after that. I don't know. I felt horrible when I heard that.
Definitely know where he's coming from.
Yeah, it's got to really suck. Karloff's makeup, though, was excellent. To me, this is the best Frankenstein that there ever is. I mean, there's some other good ones out there. I mean, there really are. I do like a lot of different Frankensteins and the way that they've portrayed them over the years. If I had to pick a number one, Boris Karloff is number one on my list.
Peter Boyle for me.
Oh, he was fair. Another thing, you know, we watched Dracula last time and we kept thinking Dracula Dead and loving it. For this movie, the whole time, I'm thinking of the different parts in Young Frankenstein. Actually, Boris Karloff's daughter, Sarah Karloff, I believe is her name, she went on record and said that her favorite movie is actually Young Frankenstein.
That's awesome.
And she said that if her father was still alive, he would absolutely have loved Young Frankenstein.
Oh, I'm sure.
And to hear his daughter say that is just, I don't know, it's just really cool. And you just can kind of picture him enjoying a movie like that. And it's just, I don't know, it just makes it for a fun thing to think about.
I actually saw Young Frankenstein before I saw the actual Frankenstein.
I did too. Actually, I think I saw Dracula Dead and Loving It before Dracula, too.
Yeah?
Well, from, I mean, I seen it when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then Dracula Dead and Loving It came out way after I saw it as a kid, but I didn't remember anything from Dracula, so technically, right. I saw Dracula Dead and Loving It first. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I had never seen Frankenstein. I watched Young Frankenstein, and that's actually what interested me in wanting to see the early Frankenstein movies.
Oh, yeah.
And I find it funny that Young Frankenstein, they kind of mix in Young Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein.
All of them, yeah.
Son of Frankenstein. You know, the whole lot of them are all mixed up into that one movie.
Yeah.
And going off on a tangent here a little bit, Mel Brooks is a genius.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I won't disagree with you there.
I mean, he's made some of my all-time favorite movies, from Blazing Saddles, Spaceballs, Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Young Frankenstein is, like, at the top. Just an amazing, amazing director and producer.
Who's still working today.
Yeah, and he's 90 freaking 7 years old. He just turned 97 a couple days ago. Happy birthday, Mel, if you have to be listening.
Well, he did go on record and say that he's going to work until he dies.
So, oh, yeah.
I have a ton of respect for the guy for just for that reason alone, because, wow.
Yeah.
Here's a guy who really loves what he does.
Oh, it's his passion. It always has been. He's still behind the scenes, and he'll post some stuff online every once and again and whatever, and he's still got that sharp wit and that humor that I love so much about him.
He's we can get more into him later.
Yeah.
But
eventually we may end up doing some of his movies.
No, we're gonna. I'd like to do Dracula Dead and Loving It. I'd love to do Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. If you guys would be interested in that, let us know.
Boris Karloff's makeup took 4 hours each day for Jack Pierce to apply, and his cumbersome costume weighed 48 pounds in the uncomfortable heat of the summertime. I cannot imagine that.
You kind of gotta wonder, in a sense, you know. I mean, there's not much they could have done as far as, you know, making the costumes cool or anything like that, but God, pick a time of the year where it ain't so freaking hot out.
Oh, I know. I guess it's just one of those things.
California in the summertime. No offense to if we have any listeners from California, but the weather sucks.
Yeah, Boris Karloff's boots that he wore weighed 13 pounds each.
Jeez.
So between the costume that he wore, all of the makeup that he had to endure, and then these boots that weighed 13 pounds each, holy shit, dude.
Yeah, that's a lot of weight in California.
Yes.
Summer weather. Jesus, 13 pounds a piece on the boots, man. That's a freaking leg workout. And you know, their schedules for doing the movie had to be, you know, 13, 14, 15-hour long days.
It was brutal back then, especially with all the practical effects that they did. It was hard work. There's a little bit of ghoulish humor when Fritz is stealing the brain. Mm. All I could think of was Abby Normal, by the way. Well, he bumps into a human skeleton there before he goes and gets the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it scares the shit out of him. That's a real human skeleton they used. Film producers found it faster and cheaper to purchase a real skeleton rather than using a fake artificial one.
Yeah, that's actually really true. Up until, if I remember correctly, the 1950s, it was a cheaper way to do that.
Which I think is a great idea anyway.
Well, don't tell the people who are in Poltergeist that.
Why is that?
There's a scene in there where the wife falls into the pool, and I'm blanking on the names right now, but she falls into the pool and there's a bunch of skeletons in it.
Mm-hmm.
They were real skeletons. And there's a theory that because they used the real skeletons, that the movie is cursed, and that's why what happened with Heather O'Rourke happened, and the girl who played the sister, who I believe was murdered by her boyfriend.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
But yeah, so in a lot of different, it's kind of like the same thing about The Exorcist and The Omen, you know,
right.
that whole curse thing that goes on. Yeah, I mean, I find it to be a bit of hogwash, but it's still interesting to think about. And it is really eerie coincidences that happened.
To me, it's all bullshit, too.
You know, you never know.
You know what's cool is Bela Lugosi, he inadvertently paved the way for Boris Karloff's fame. I mean, when you think about it, if Lugosi hadn't turned down the role of the monster, because he was I've heard a couple different things. I heard that Bela Lugosi turned down the role, and then I heard that James Whale didn't want Bela Lugosi for the role because he didn't want people to get confused with monsters or something like that back then.
Right.
So I don't know what the hell to believe, because I've heard two different stories, but if he did turn it down, he pretty much paved the way for Boris Karloff. Karloff might have forever remained not have known for the obscure villain and everything that he became.
Yeah.
You know, confined to doing for the 10 years since arriving in Hollywood. And I mean, because before Frankenstein, he did a lot of movies before Frankenstein.
Oh, sure.
But Frankenstein,
and a lot of movies after.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Frankenstein was his big breakthrough. Mm-hmm. This is what made him super famous and super well known.
Yeah, from what I understand, Bela turned down the role, and I found it kind of funny. His reasoning behind it was he thought he was too handsome to play such a horrid looking monster.
Yeah, that was one that I heard too, and I could kind of agree with him in a way. But then again, if you look at some of the other roles that he did after, it's
yeah,
like, okay,
he played Igor in what was it, Son of Frankenstein?
One of the Son, Ghost, House, I don't know, one of those.
I think he played it in Son of Frankenstein and Ghost of Frankenstein. I don't know about House of Frankenstein. And he looked pretty freaking weird in those movies.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, the same thing with White Zombie. He looked a little monstrous in that, too.
Yeah.
Hairy monster of a guy.
I can tell you what, though, it would definitely have been a different movie if
Bela
would have played the part of Frankenstein.
I would have been interested to have seen how it came out, but honestly, I think Boris Karloff is the reason why this movie became so big. I think that we would, like, if they did use Bela Lugosi, people would know Frankenstein, but they wouldn't know him like we know him today.
Right. And it's just, I think it worked out for the best, because, I mean, Boris was absolutely amazing in this role.
He really was. He was responsible for a lot of great ideas on the set, too. The whole sunken eyes thing, that was his idea.
Yeah.
And then he took out his partials to make his face look more sunk in.
Yeah.
The whole, like, for instance, there's this one scene. It's when you first see the monster, and it does that close-up shot. Closer and closer, and then bam, it shows him close up, and it looks like his eyes are kind of like up into his head a little bit. That was all Boris Karloff's idea. He thought that the monster should look not totally alive, but also not totally dead, but kind of like sleepy in a little way.
Right.
Because that's what he is. He's a dead guy that just came back to life.
That
got put together. And I think it was a fantastic idea that Karloff came up with that.
Oh, yeah, same here.
Many can argue that the creature should be called the monster and not Frankenstein. And a lot of people get this confused, and it drives me fucking crazy. But however, the second film's title, Bride of Frankenstein, and that came out in 1935, and we're going to be doing that one too, so we'll have a lot to say about that movie. Apparently, that movie settles this debate. Within the series of films, the monster is nicknamed by his creator's last name.
Right.
And is simply known as Frankenstein, since the bride was created for him and not for his own creator.
Right.
So I could understand why a lot of people would refer to him as Frankenstein and not the monster.
Frankenstein.
But I guess now it kind of depends on which movie you're talking about.
Yeah.
He'll always be the monster to me, though.
Oh, yeah. Again, even before I saw this movie, I read the book by Mary Shelley. And again, if you have not read this book, go read it. It's phenomenal.
All right, I'll be right back.
You didn't read the book?
No, I did not.
For
never read the book.
Shame.
I'm not a reader. I'll admit it. I'm a movie guy. That's why we're doing this podcast.
The book is really good.
Real quick, let me interrupt you. We got the movie playing in the background. And one thing I wanted to point out, in the beginning of the movie, while they're digging, they're digging up the cadaver, there is a grim friggin' reaper in the background holding a sword. And I'm watching this and I'm wondering, maybe for the time or maybe just for the sake of the movie, but what in the freaking hell... Why is that there other than for effect? It's so weird to me.
I'm
It looks like a cheap Halloween.
You know, don't quote me on this, but I think back in the times this movie took place in, they would put statues like that in cemeteries. I don't know why.
I mean, it's cool, but I just never heard of anything like that. So watching this movie today, I see this and I'm like, what's with the freaking Halloween prop in this?
It looks like a cover of a metal album.
It does.
Something Grim Reaper would do.
So we should get into the movie plot, I suppose. Like I said on the last episode, there shockingly, a lot of people have not seen this movie, but they know the story. They know who Frankenstein is. You've seen him everywhere. Masks in Halloween stores, in other movies and comedies, on cereal boxes. I mean, you name it.
On your wall.
Yes. Oh, he's just been everywhere. But it still shocks me that a lot of people have not actually sat down and watched this movie. And it's not even a long movie. It's a little bit over an hour. It's like an hour and 9 minutes, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
So movies back then really weren't very long movies. So, Fritz, I wanted to point out, is also played by Dwight Frye, who was Renfield in Dracula.
Yes, he was.
And he did a fantastic job in Frankenstein as well as Dracula, too. I think he's a terrific actor.
He's played in quite a few of the Universal Monster movies, if I remember correctly.
I'm not sure, but we'll find out once we watch all of them.
Yeah, really.
I just know that he's been in these two movies for now, and he did an amazing job. He really is fun to watch. Let's get into the plot and talk about it a little bit, and have some fun here with this. This is a real treat for us, Frankenstein. We've been wanting to do this one for... Hell, we've just been wanting to do all the Universal Monsters for a long time. You're going to hear us say, like, every episode that this is one of our favorite movies. One of our favorite movies. I've heard you say that in multiple episodes that we've done, Mike. This is one of your favorite movies.
I got a lot of favorite movies.
I do as well. It's hard to choose a favorite. They're all mostly our favorites.
It all, you know, falls under the category of what, you know, genre or subgenre or what have you you're talking about.
This is true. So before the film actually begins, this guy, Edward Van Sloan, steps out in front of the curtain to warn the audience about what they're about to see and tell them that they still have a chance to leave the theater, concluding with a sly grin and the words, "Well, we've warned you." And then it goes into where you see Dr. Henry Frankenstein, who is played by the great Colin Clive, an ardent young scientist, and his devoted assistant, Fritz, not Igor or Igor, Fritz, played by Dwight Frye. It was a really fantastic cast in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Fritz is a hunchback, and they piece together a human body, the parts of which they've secretly collected from various sources, of course. And Frankenstein's consuming desire is to create human life through various electrical devices, which he has perfected. And I also want to point out, and it's funny because I haven't read the book, but I have heard things about it, that they didn't use electricity in the original novel. And that started in this movie. So anything you hear that has to do with Frankenstein and the electricity all came from the 1931 Frankenstein, James Whale's idea.
Now, if you want to see a film more accurate to the book, they did one earlier, a Frankenstein movie earlier, that was called Frankenstein or the Modern Day Prometheus. Not entirely sure of what year it came out. I mean, you can find it, and it's a really rough cut. It's actually kind of hard to watch, but it's very interesting because it's the earliest known production of Frankenstein. So,
but that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a chance and you can find it, it's definitely worth a watch. It's not very long, and it is a silent movie.
I'll have to check this out myself.
It's interesting.
I haven't seen it, but I have heard of it before. So Elizabeth, played by Mae Clark, is Henry's fiance, and she's worried to distraction over his peculiar actions, and she can't understand why he secludes himself in an abandoned watchtower, and boy, does it look abandoned. This is all a set. They did a fantastic job with making everything, I mean, for this time, for making everything look just so, I mean, it looked so good.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know this is 1931, so it's really hard to, you can't really compare, I mean, you can, but like I've said before, you gotta get in in the right state of mind when you watch these movies and go back in time and kind of just put yourself in that time frame.
Yeah.
And think about how it was, or at least would be, back then. We're a little bit more closer to this time, if that makes any sense. I mean, we heard about it a lot when we were kids. I mean, a lot of people were still talking about these movies, you know, when I was like 8 years old, back in like, you know, the late 80s.
Oh,
and
yeah.
it seemed still fresh in some people's minds. But now in 2024, it's amazing at how many people don't even really talk about these movies anymore. Right. Or once again, like I've said, haven't even fucking seen these movies.
I think that it's kind of a generational gap, even between, you know, our generation and the next generation. But the fact that these movies were still being talked about as much as they were in the 80s and 90s goes to show how much of a powerful impact they had. And they are still talked about today, maybe not as much as they used to be, but they're still, I mean, there's groups on Facebook that are dedicated to the Universal horror movies.
If you look for it, you can find it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, which is cool. I mean, that's one of the plus sides of social media.
Yeah.
And when we were kids growing up, we didn't have social media. So to hear about it talked about as much as it was talked about then is pretty amazing.
We can't emphasize just how important these movies were. In my own opinion, not only us, but...
Very important. We can't emphasize that enough. We really cannot.
These movies had such a massive impact on cinema as a whole. So...
I thought you said cinnamon roll. Cinema as a whole. Yes. Moving on. So back to the movie plot. So Henry has... equipped as a laboratory in the abandoned watchtower and refuses to see anyone. So Elizabeth and her friend Victor Moritz, who's played by John Bowles, another fantastic actor. And I find it funny that his name is Victor and not...
I was going to say the same thing.
Because they named him Henry, and I don't remember the reason why they did that. It's not important, but I found it a little bit funny.
And it's funny because I never noticed that until recently.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, though. But
yeah.
So they go to Dr. Waldman, his old medical professor, and ask Dr. Waldman's help in reclaiming the young scientist from his absorbing experiments. So Elizabeth... intent on rescuing Frankenstein, arrives just as the eager young medico is making his final test. Now, they all watch Frankenstein and Fritz, the hunchback, as they raise the dead creature on an operating table. They raise the operating table high into the room toward an opening at the top of the laboratory. I like to say the laboratory. And then, of course, a terrific crash of thunder. Boom. The crackling of Frankenstein's electric machines and the hand of Frankenstein's monster begins to move. Not at first, but starts to move. And then we get the famous quote from Henry here.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
So the manufactured monster is the monster. Strangely, he's hideous, startling, grotesque, gruesome. Inhuman form.
They don't look good either.
Well, I mean, well, he does, but I mean, he doesn't look good as no, he doesn't look good. The makeup and stuff looks great from a fan's point of view, or the person watching it, but not. God damn it, Mike. So he's held in a dungeon in the watchtower. They put him in a different room, I guess. Through Fitz's error, Fritz's. Through Fritz's error, Abby Normal, a criminal brain. He got a criminal brain because he dropped the one that he was going to get for Frankenstein, and he just grabbed whatever one was there.
You promise you won't get mad?
Was secured for Frankenstein's experiments, which supposedly result in the monster knowing only hate, horror, and murder. He's pretty much got the brain of a child, this monstrous guy. I mean, if you watch him, the way his movements, his facial expressions, very subtle facial expressions. And I was watching closely when we were watching this last night, and it is very much like, kind of like a child in certain parts.
Oh, yeah.
It's... so impressive and amazing how Boris Karloff played this part completely silent. And in the original one, he wasn't silent.
No.
They mentioned that he just wouldn't shut up. And James Whale wanted Frankenstein's monster in this to be silent and play it silent. He thought it would be scarier.
And in the later movies, he...
Well, he talks a little bit more, a little bit, you know.
Well, in...
Smoke, good, things like that.
Bride of Frankenstein, he started to talk, but in the later movies, especially in like Ghost of Frankenstein, he again couldn't, he wouldn't shut up.
Right. So, yeah, I remember that. I haven't seen that one in a long time, but we'll have to revisit that one too.
So, yeah, we're going to go through those eventually.
So, however, when we're first introduced to the monster, it seems that it's not, in fact, a malevolent beast, but he's simple, innocent, if scary-looking creation. And Frankenstein welcomes it into the laboratory and asks, well, he asks his creation to sit, which it does, and they call him an it. He looks like an it.
They were being gender appropriate.
Yes. Fritz, however, enters with a flaming torch, which frightens the fuck out of him. And this part really was a bit unnerving for me. Was it you?
Yeah, a little bit.
I was watching it and I was like, damn, I don't remember Fritz being such a bastard to the, you know, poor guy. Like, you really feel bad for the monster here. He looks terrified. He doesn't know any better.
Right.
It's not his fault.
I think that it's implied that there was some jealousy there because Fritz is so loyal to
Frankenstein.
Yeah. And you know, here comes the monster who is, you know, Frankenstein's creation, and I feel like Fritz may have found out, you know, may have thought that he was going to be replaced.
Well, Fritz gets what's coming to him.
Yes, he does.
And I wasn't at all sympathetic when this happened. I was more on the monster side at this point.
Right.
So yeah, it's Fritz mistaken by Frankenstein and Dr. Waldman as an attempt to attack them, and so it's taken to the cellars where it's chained. They chain him up, thinking that it's not fit for society, which it's definitely not, at least not yet. And they think that it's going to wreak havoc at any chance. And so they leave the monster locked up. This is where Fritz antagonizes the monster with a torch. As Henry and Dr. Waldman consider the fate of the monster, they hear an unearthly, terrifying shriek from the dungeon. And you know right away it's Fritz. You can hear him screaming his head off. Frankenstein and Dr. Waldman, they rush in to find the monster strangled Fritz. And he tied him. He, like, strangled him. And he's, like, hanging by his neck, I think, right? He's hanging there. And the monster makes a lunge at the two, but they escape. And it's understandable because the monster's terrified at this point. You know, he had Fritz coming at him with a torch. And he just doesn't want to get hurt. So he's just kind of defending himself. So they lock the monster inside. So realizing that the creature must be destroyed, Henry prepares an injection. Sedative! That's all I kept thinking of was young Frankenstein at this part. Hey, handsome! So they prepare an injection of a powerful drug, and they both conspire to release the monster and inject it as it's attacking, brutally attacking. I mean, you look at Boris Karloff, he really wasn't a big bulky guy. He was tall, and they made him kind of bulky for this, you know, with the suit and that he put on and everything. And he did have somewhat of the physique, but he really wasn't a huge guy. But in this movie, you see him, you know, lunging at you, and it's just like, wow. I'd love to see this in 3D.
Oh, yeah.
To be honest. When the door's unlocked, the creature emerges and lunges right at Dr. Frankenstein, and Dr. Waldman injects the drug into the creature's back. And I love this part because the facial expressions that Boris Karloff makes, again, they're very subtle, but how he comes across, how he makes these facial expressions is just outstanding. You look at his face and he starts to, like, look around like he doesn't know what the hell's happening, and then he gets a little tired and then he passes out. When I saw this scene, my first thought was, wow, that was good. Well, that's better acting than a lot of the stuff you see today.
Oh yeah, and you also gotta figure, I mean, he was making these expressions with about 9,000 pounds of makeup on his face. So.
Yeah. And in the heat and...
Oh, yeah.
So that probably was... It was pretty genuine at the time because of how he probably did want to pass out. The next movie we're doing is The Mummy. And there's actually a rumor that he actually did pass out of some sort of heat exhaustion from being in all of the heavy makeup and bandages.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's amazing what some of these actors went through.
Yeah.
So the monster knocks Dr. Waldman to the floor and has nearly killed Henry. When the drug takes effect, he falls to the floor unconscious. Fantastic scene. Henry leaves to prepare for his wedding while Dr. Waldman conducts an examination of the unconscious creature. And as he's preparing to begin dissecting it, and it's funny, at this part, my girlfriend goes, "Why don't they just fucking decapitate him?" And I'm like, "Well, that would be the end of the movie then."
Yeah, short-ass movie.
I mean, you could, but I think the reason why maybe he wanted to dissect them was to just kind of look through and experiment a little bit more, I guess. And plus, they probably didn't think, you know, I mean, he's unconscious and he's tied down to a table. You don't think that there's any danger, any real danger there.
Right.
But the creature awakens and he strangles him. They should have had his hands tied down because, yeah, when he wakes up, he's got his arm around him, the back of the neck, and he sits up and strangles him, and he kills him, right? You don't see him the rest of the movie. He's dead.
Don't start trying to dissect these movies because it's kind of a house of cards.
It's true. A lot of this, you really do have to just overlook and just say, okay.
It's a movie.
It's from 1931. This is just how it was done. And they did the best that they could with what they worked with, and that's it.
It's like the bats and Dracula. That's all I'm saying.
So the monster escapes from the tower and wanders through the landscape. This is where the movie gets really fun. It then has a short encounter with a little farmer's daughter named Maria, who asks him to play a game with her where they would throw flowers into the lake so they appeared like little boats. And this girl's really sweet, really cute. A little piece of trivia where I think the girl's mother was a little bit afraid.
She was a raging bitch, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she put her on a diet and everything too.
Well, she, from what I understand, she was one of these types that was trying to live her dream of being a famous actress through her daughter. And I guess that the little girl was absolutely terrified of her mother.
Well, she was a really sweet girl, and when she first saw Boris Karloff in makeup, I mean, everyone was a little on edge of how she was going to react to Boris Karloff as the monster.
Yeah, she loved him.
She did. She ran right up to him, grabbed him by the hand, and said, "Can I ride with you?"
Yeah.
On the way to the set, and he leans over and goes, "Would you, darling?" And I guess he was just a sweetheart of a guy.
Yeah.
She wasn't afraid of him. He was really good with kids, from what I've heard. Everybody loved him. Mm-hmm. Just a really gentle giant.
Well, like I said, he was a very well-spoken, intelligent English gentleman.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. So as the monster takes much pleasure in the game and his playmate, it picks up the little girl, because he ran out of flowers and he's looking around and he doesn't see any more of the flowers. So he picks her up and he throws her into the lake in a playful sort of kind of way. He didn't know what he was doing. I don't think he was trying to hurt her. It was just kind of like a misunderstanding to everybody else in the town when the town finds out about this, because that is a big deal. So he throws her in, and as he becomes aware of the consequences of his careless doing, tries to get a hold of her unsuccessfully, and then he goes off running.
Yeah.
He freaks out a little bit, and he walks off pretty troubled.
I always wonder if maybe him walking off like that, in his mind, he was going to look for help, or if he was just scared of the situation and wanted to get away. Or
it could have been a number of things. Yeah. I mean, he didn't know any better. He probably didn't know what the hell he did.
Right.
The portion of the sequence where the monster throws her in, it was censored at the time of the film's original release. It's been restored in modern prints, obviously, but at the time, I guess it was a little too violent, they thought, so they cut it from the original release.
Which, considering some of today's movies, is kind of funny.
It is. So he walks off troubled. With preparations for the wedding completed, Frankenstein is once again himself and serenely happy with Elizabeth. They are to marry as soon as Dr. Waldman arrives, but we all know what happened to him. Victor rushes in, saying that the doctor's been found strangled in the operating room. Frankenstein suspects the monster, of course, and a chilling scream convinces him that the friend is in his house. So the monster gains access to Elizabeth's room, and this part's cool. While preparing to film the scene where the monster attacks Elizabeth, and it's kind of a short scene, I guess they didn't really know like how it was going to go down. But Mae Clark admitted to Boris Karloff that she was worried that when she saw him in full makeup, you know, lunging toward her, she actually might be really frightened. So Karloff told her that throughout the scene, he would wiggle his pinky finger out of sight of the camera so that despite the horrific makeup, she could always see that it's just Boris Karloff waving to her and letting her know that she was safe. And I think that that's just really cool. I can get an image of him like lunging at her, and when the camera doesn't show him, he's got his hands out and he's just wiggling his pinky.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of guy Boris Karloff was, though. He's just, and he plays the character so well.
Now, there's a part that we forgot to talk about that I wanted to elaborate on, where Frankenstein is holding his hands up. I've always loved that part because it really shows the innocence of the monster. And on the special features, one of the people talking actually said something that I really do agree with. He said it was almost like the monster was trying to grab a soul.
Grab a soul and asking for a soul. Yeah.
So that's always been a really cool part of the movie for me, at least.
Also the part where he's sitting down and he's got his hands out and he doesn't know what to do with them and he's kind of moving them back and forth a little bit. He doesn't know really what he's doing.
Right.
So when the searchers arrive, they find her unconscious on the bed, and the monster's escaped. He is only intent upon destroying Frankenstein. So leading an enraged band of peasants, Frankenstein searches the surrounding country for the monster. And he becomes separated from the band and is discovered by the monster, who attacks him. This might be my favorite scene, at least for atmosphere, because they're like up on this like mountaintop. And I don't know, something about the lighting and just how the monster lunges at him and attacks him and everything, and then he carries him up. And also, I gotta point out, when we watch this, when we watch all these, they're all the restored versions,
mm-hmm.
and they're on Blu-ray, so they're very easy to watch. It's such a treat, because I said on the last episode, I've never seen the restorations of these films. Have you? I don't think you have either, Mike.
No, this is my first time, and I, again, I'm really glad that they did restore them.
Mm-hmm.
Because watching them in their non-restored versions is rough.
Yeah, a little bit. So as the standoff between the creator and his creation begins, Frankenstein tries to intimidate the monster with his torch. It does not cower as it did before when Fritz was doing it, and he manages to knock it out of his hands. After a struggle, the monster knocks Frankenstein unconscious, and this is where he carries him up to the old mill. And the peasants, they hear his cries and they follow and they send dogs after him and everything. Finally, they reach the mill and they find the monsters climbed up to the very top. And this part's really suspenseful and just really hilarious to watch too, especially when they're in between that like wheel,
mm-hmm.
and he's like trying to get away from them and they see each other through like the space in between that wheel. It's like they're playing a game or something. In a burst of rage, he hurls Victor to the ground. Well, he lands on the part of the windmill, and you can tell it's a dummy. It would have to be.
Well, they really couldn't use a real person.
I think it was CGI. So his fall, broken by the veins of the windmill, saves him from instant death, apparently. And some of the villagers hurry him to his home while the others remain to burn the mill and destroy the monster inside. It's a pretty... You know, one thing I do love about these movies, or at least this one for right now, there's no... They don't screw around. I mean, they get right into it scene after scene. There's no... Basically no nonsense. And that's what I love about these old movies, too. There's no side story or anything like that.
Well, you have the main focus on the main characters, and you know that was it. And I do enjoy to a point some exposition in movies, a little bit of character building and stuff like that, some subplot and whatnot. But some movies take it way too far.
And Frankenstein, they don't really take it at all anywhere.
No,
you just pretty much know what Frankenstein is doing and what his mission is, and everybody else is just kind of going along with it. And then there's the monster, and that's it. That's how it was back then with these movies, and it was genius.
Well, there's not much of a plot, but what plot there is done very well, and
very much so.
You know, again, it's not close to the way the book was, but for what they did, especially at the time they did it, just think they did an amazing job with it.
So later, back at Frankenstein's castle, Frankenstein's father, Baron Frankenstein, they celebrate the wedding of his recovered son with a toast to a future grandchild, and that's the end. Once again, it ended very abruptly.
I love the character Baron Frankenstein.
He was a riot, wasn't he? He was goofy. He was just, meh, you know.
Like when the Burgermeister.
Yeah.
He's coming in. Yeah, that's probably how I'm going to be when I'm that age.
I hope so. So that's the end. That's the whole plot. Into the ratings, Mike. But first, before the ratings, I've been curious to ask you. Out of these two movies we've done so far, between Dracula and Frankenstein, which would you pick as your personal favorite?
Dracula.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I love Frankenstein, but I don't know. Something about Dracula was just more appealing to me. They're two very different characters.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that Boris Karloff didn't do a fantastic job as the monster. I think for me, it's just the sophistication of Dracula, the way he carries himself, and the acting abilities of Bela Lugosi that puts that over as far as being one of my favorite Universal horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's understandable, though. So let's get into the ratings. Again, I didn't write up any rating. I just simply put a 10. For so many reasons, as we've talked about everything up to this point, it's just a very original. I mean, it's the original horror show. It's Frankenstein. It was the first of its kind to do the character like this, played by an amazing actor, Boris Karloff. And so, yeah, my rating is just simple 10 all the way. Mike?
Oh, yeah, it's a 10.
One thing I wanted to mention was, I think it was on Son of Frankenstein. They celebrated his birthday on the set, and he said that he got the best birthday gift ever, and that was when his daughter Sarah was born. He ended up leaving the set to go see his daughter being born.
Oh, that's awesome.
Or to go, you know, be with her after she was born or something like that. But it's just great. He just seemed like such a great dad, too. Yeah. I've never heard anything bad about him. I have some final thoughts. I think that this is held up far better as a work of art than Dracula. It helped that the actors took a more serious approach in this production. And as you know, we've talked about in the last episode, if you've listened to it, if not, go check it out. I mentioned that the actors and actresses in that didn't really take a serious approach to that movie, other than Bela Lugosi, of course.
Right.
He took it very seriously. He thought he was Dracula in some cases. But I have to attribute this approach to that of James Whale's direction. His vision stamped on every scene, and he knew how to get the most out of his cast. And from what I understand, he was he was great to work with. He was a visionary.
So you'd say this was a whale of a tale?
Oh, my fucking God, Mike. God damn it.
I'm sorry.
So thanks to James Whale. Well, we better be moving on.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't help myself.
So thanks to James Whale. The film world was given the great Boris Karloff, thanks to James. And it's impossible to imagine earlier horror films without him, to be honest. In fact, he became the heir to the late, great Lon Chaney, the man of 1,000 faces.
Yep.
His portrayal of the monster makes you really care about what happens to him. You know, as I was saying before, especially the scene with the torch, you care about the monster because you know he's innocent and he didn't do anything wrong. Acting through the brilliant makeup and without a single line of dialogue, his gestures, body language, and expressions convey more than any of his growls or screams or whatever he makes. Overall, Frankenstein has held up very well over the years, and it's still engaging to watch. It really is. The performances are top-notch. The imagery just pops before your eyes, especially if you watch the restoration of it, which we did. It was outstanding. Mike was mentioning to me because he watched it before I did. I think he watched it, I watched it last night. You watched it the day before?
Yeah, I watched it on Sunday.
And I remember asking you, how was it? And the first thing I think you said was, amazing to watch.
It's absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And again, when I first saw these movies, it was the non-restored versions, which for the time, they were great. They did not age well as far as visually. So if you do watch them, I do recommend watching the restored versions. It's a lot easier on the eyes.
And if you're old school horror fans like us, I mean, maybe you'll enjoy the original versions. But I think I'm with you. I would watch the restored versions first. But Boris Karloff as the monster is just as iconic as ever in this.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a classic old school monster movie that doesn't really, it doesn't rely on gore or obvious jump scares. It's that, that's not what these movies were. That stuff really is a dying art. And you think about it, it's just being overdone.
Yes, I agree.
It's such redundant. So yeah, my last words, highly, highly recommendable to old school horror fans. And if you've never seen this and you're curious, you know what? Give it a shot. You might really enjoy it. So, with that being said, this was our second installment of Universal Monsters. I loved revisiting this movie again. It was great to watch this and learn all about the different actors, actresses, Boris Karloff especially, of course. It was great to see the big green monster up on the screen because it's been, I think I saw this back in 2020, early 2020. So it's been a few years for me since I've actually seen this. Mike, when was the last time you saw this movie other than the other day?
Yeah, about 2005.
Oh, wow. So it must have been a really big treat for you.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely been a while.
Yeah, our next installment is going to be The Mummy, which also features Boris Karloff. So you're going to get to hear more about him and what we think of The Mummy. And I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. Although I have to say, out of all of the Universal Monsters, I think The Mummy is probably last on my list for reasons I'll get into when we talk about it.
You're insane.
It's a great movie. It's just once we revisit the movie and watch it again, maybe I'll have a different opinion. The last time I think I saw The Mummy was, it must have been 2014, maybe 2013. I don't know. It was a while ago, and I didn't really enjoy it as much as I thought I would at that time. But we'll see, you know, on our next episode.
Well, it's just like when we revisit The Invisible Man. You know, that's your favorite out of all of them, and that's probably my least favorite.
Mm-hmm. So this completes our 18th episode of the Chainsaw Enema Show. Thank you guys for listening once again. Remember, you can listen to our previous episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, iHeart, and more. If you got any questions, comments, suggestions, or even requests, you can go to our Facebook page and send us a message or leave a comment. Like the page, whatever. And remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts. That really does help. Don't forget to lock your doors and windows. Check the closet and look under the bed. Until the next time, I'm Johnny B. Ghoul.
And I'm Misfit Mike.
Always remember, keep the horror alive.
You have created a monster and it will destroy you.